Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society equips and encourages Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. To learn more about us, our events, our journal, Pietas, to sign up for our newsletter and make your tax-deductible gift, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society. Before we get started, please join me in prayer. And because of today's topic of catechesis, I thought I'd start with this prayer for the Universal Christian Church, which is a collect from William Laud found in the 2019 Book of Common Prayer. It goes, Gracious Father, we pray for your holy Catholic Church. Fill it with all truth, in all truth with all peace. Where it is corrupt, purify it. Where it is in error, direct it. Where in anything it is amiss, reform it. Where it is right, strengthen it. Where it is in want, provide for it. Where it is divided, reunite it. For the sake of Jesus Christ, your Son, our Savior. Amen. I'm grateful to be joined today by Alex Fogelman. Dr. Fogelman is the Associate Dean for Special Programs and Assistant Professor of Theology at Trinity Anglican Seminary, where he oversees the Robert E. Weber Center and the Doctor of Ministry Program. He also directs the Catechesis Task Force for the Anglican Church of North America. He is the author of Knowledge, Faith, and Early Christian Initiation, published by Cambridge in 2023. And the subject of today's episode is his book, Making Disciples, Catechesis in History, Theology, and Practice, published by Erdmans this year. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Thank you, Josh. So good to be with you.
Alex, this book is exceptional. At 163 pages plus in appendices, it packs a ton of theological and practical wisdom that I think any Christian would benefit from. I learned a lot and ran into a number of thinkers, anecdotes, and writings I had never heard of. If I had a staff, which I don't, I would require them to read this, as I think it gets to a lot of what we're aiming to promote as an organization. So in some ways, I want to promote this book. There is a little bit of self-serving here because I think there's a lot of common ground in terms of what I hope we as a Ciceronian Society are doing and what you're arguing for in this book. So let's start with this. Why this book? Why now?
That's a great question. And also, I think, helpful that you connect it to the work of the society. This is something I've been thinking about for a number of years. And it's, I guess, in some ways, I'd hear a number of people who I thought were very wise, very thoughtful Christians, talking about the renewal of catechesis. And at first, it sparked my interest. I was like, what does that even mean? That's not part of my sort of natural vocabulary. And what I came to see is that they were talking about something much broader and larger than, renewing our children's Sunday school curriculum or something like that. It was a connection between how we think about culture and how we think about education and formation. And it's rooting that kind of renewal, cultural renewal and educational renewal within the church. So it's starting at the very basic level, the very foundations of culture and renewal, and thinking about those within the coming from within the life of the church. So thinking about the church as a culture, thinking about that as a primary locus of what we're on about. So yeah, it's connected to me, and I think you perceive this rightly, that what I'm advocating here in this book called Making Disciples is actually about a much broader level of cultural renewal. So that's maybe some of the orientation for why this book, why now. I'm all for, indoctrinating children with the catechism or something like that, but that's a very small part. That's not really what the book is about. It's more about thinking about renewal of the church, renewal of culture, and all of life, but thinking about it from within rather than from without the church.
Yeah, and in within the church, I think that's important. But one of the things you also mentioned, this is actually on page 7 of the book, you explicitly mentioned that you had the classical ed movement in mind when writing this, or at least part of that. And a huge part of our audience is from that classical ed movement. So I'm wondering why were they in your mind as you were doing this?
Yeah, this was something I came across early on. I want to say it was a Caldecott. What's his name?
Oh gosh.
You know who I'm thinking about. Stratford Caldecott. I'm so sorry if I'm butchering that for all your audience. It's like this guy doesn't, he's not really one of us. I was reading that one of his books earlier on. I came across him, I think, through Ken Myers' Marcel Audio, which is again kind of the same sort of space. But I read one of his books when I was early on thinking about this catechesis project, like several years ago, and thinking like, this is what I'm doing. Like I'm thinking about this, but I'm thinking about it maybe and again a slightly more like from the church base. I'm not a part of like a lot of the classical education networks or things like that, but I realized, I think I perceived this sort of congruity between what I was interested in, what kind of classical education movement folks were interested in. And then, so as I was writing, some of that was just in the background. And then earlier this year, I participated in a Alcuin Fellowship gathering. And that was the first time I'd sort of actually been more officially involved with some of the classical education conversations. And it was a sort of like meeting of long lost friends. They were like, you're, and I just presented more on the early church catechumenate, some of the research that came out of that. There's a chapter in the book on sort of the development of catechesis in the early church. And really, I say this explicitly in the book and have written a little bit about this elsewhere, but seeing catechesis as part of the early Christian sort of takeover of classical paideia. It's sort of a way of bringing that classical education model into the early church, and deploying some of the ways that they're thinking about education and formation. So I presented on some of this material, and the classical education people were like, that's what we're doing. So it came about both, I think, from my own sort of intuitions about what the classical education movement was about, but as an outsider, and then increasingly over the years, I've seen some of those layers thicken. So yeah, I very much have sort of seen that alignment. And again, for me, it's primarily come through focusing on early church. Like that was my sort of doctoral work, was on the development of catechesis in the early church. And it comes through a lot in this book. It doesn't take a mystery detective to figure out that I'm a
Patristics
big
guy.
devotee of the patristics. But yeah, that's, I think, where some of the overlap comes is in that sort of retrieval of classical paideia as a way of thinking about, again, both education, but more broadly than that, as a transformation, the passing on of a culture, way of life, that sort of thing.
Well, and I think your intuition is obviously correct there, and classical education seems to be in not as it's not just a different curriculum. It
That's
is a
right.
different set of assumptions about what it means to be a human person, what it means to be civilized, what it means to be moral, right? And I think there's a lot of reasons where we're going back to that. And just like catechesis is a recovery or a reminder or a refocusing on a biblical understanding of what it means to be human, who God is, how we worship and love Him, and share that love with others. I think there's so much overlap there. So I just want to exhort our listeners, those who are in the classical ed movement, this book is very much for you. I think you'll find a lot of I don't want to call them rabbit trails, but there is. I mean, in some ways, I just you know
Yeah,
it,
that's
it,
right.
it, it, you, the book was very focused and well organized, but there were times where I'm just like, well, I want to go this way with it. And that's not a criticism. I was just excited. I thought, okay, wait, who is this guy that you just brought up? Or I didn't know Augustine wrote that too.
Yeah.
It's something like that. But I want to make sure we're solid on the terminology here because catechesis, again, I come from you and I are both Anglican, but I also come from an evangelical background, and so that word was not something we used, right? Catechesis is
Yeah.
what those Catholics do, right?
Yeah.
And or what the Lutherans do, right? Or something like that. Now, so what do you mean by it? And I'd also wonder if you could just is it the same as the word discipleship? Is it the same as like the word formation? I think those three words often go together lately: catechesis, discipleship, formation. But what do you mean by it when you say catechesis?
Yeah, great. The way I define it in the book is a basic but comprehensive introduction or instruction in what Christians believe, hope, and love. And and then in the book, I'll unpack each of those, the five key words there, I guess. It's basic in the sense that it's foundational, but also in the sense that it can be countercultural. It hits at the basic sort of gut level narratives of in which the gospel is speaking, the culture in which the gospel is speaking. So it hits at that basic level, but it's also comprehensive in that it's intended to give a whole vision of the Christian life and not just one aspect of it. If I've seen one kind of like tendency within thinking about catechesis or discipleship, then it would be a tendency to sort of like take one aspect of the Christian life rather than to take the whole together. So that's right. I use the faith, hope, and love as sort of cipher for doctrine, spirituality, and ethics or the moral life. So seeing those three as a sort of triadic way to get at the comprehensive nature of the Christian life. So it's not just what we think, but it very much is. It includes what we think, how we think about the Christian life, the sort of creedal aspect. A lot of people have noted that in their Christianity is kind of peculiarly creedal. Like they're very Christians are interested in what we think, like what we believe is true. But at the same time, it's not only that, it also includes the relational, what we might call spirituality, or the sort of affective character of the Christian life. So about the affections, the dispositions, the intuitions that we have as Christian, how we experience the world, and especially how we relate to God. And then finally, the ethical or the aspect of love and the faith, hope, and love triad. It is about how we live in the world, the ethos, the moral life. So there's different ways of thinking about that. The sort of catechetical tradition that's come from the Reformation has emphasized those three especially utilizing the Creed, the Lord's Prayer, and the Ten Commandments. And so I map those three: Creed, Lord's Prayer, Ten Commandments, not as ends in themselves, but as symbolic or even a sort of a sacramental type of quality, that the Creed is a symbol for the entirety of Christian belief. The Lord's Prayer is enunciate, a small form of how Christians relate to God more broadly, and the Ten Commandments as unpacking or allowing us to unpack a much broader ethos, the entirety of the Christian way of life. So it's not to say that that's all there is to say, but this provides, I think, as useful of a framework as any other that I've seen for thinking about discipleship. So I'm happy to just call that discipleship. But many people mean many different things by discipleship. I think it's probably, if you're going to use the word discipleship, which I'm happy to use, and the title Making Disciples was a suggestion, strong suggestion from the publisher and the editor, but I was very happy with that. I think it well summarizes what I'm after here when I'm talking about making disciples. So catechesis, I think, does that, and I think it provides a little more specificity, a little more clarity. Same with formation. I'm happy with all of that language. I would be remiss not to mention a good friend of mine, Kyle Hughes's book, Teaching for Spiritual Formation, which applies a sort of, especially a patristic model, bringing that specifically into questions about classical education. It's that emphasis on formation, but I'm trying to maybe provide a little more teeth to that, a little more specificity, something like that, with the way that I describe catechesis.
Well, a lot of this is rooted in the history that you're going through too,
That's right.
which I was, I mean that we could spend a couple of days on this. I don't want to take too long, but I love the patristics, I love the early church, and there were so many things in here that I had never even heard of or knew, and just surprises around every corner, which I was really excited about. A lot of places where you could develop more research here, I think, just encouraging our listeners there. I don't want to dwell too much on this because there's so many good things in the second half of the book, but in a general sense, when you're looking at the early church, especially someone who's already rooted in the patristics as you are, what surprised you? I was surprised how early some of the systematic thinking and development of catechesis, how early it started, first of all, that was surprising to me. I also you maybe mentioned the use of church music and hymns, and how that played a role. What surprised you specifically for this book in working on catechesis?
I try to be that's my approach to patristics is assuming that I don't know what they're talking about. And so I have learned, I think, to go into reading the patristics with a posture of, I assume I don't know what they're talking about, and I try to take seriously my own ignorance. And so I continually surprised by just the way they go about things, the way they use scripture in catechesis, I think was a surprising aspect. It's both, there's a lot of resonances with how we think about sort of narrative of scripture today, sort of like we would talk today about, finding your place in the large narrative of scripture. But then they're doing that, Irenaeus is doing that, Augustine's doing a version of this. It's not what we're doing, but it's I always just, I see more difference than that. But there a lot of these sort of handholds that we're looking for today, like again, the convergence of the intellect and the affect and the ethos. Like we're struggling today in the modern world to find the congruence, the sort of unity of these things. We sort of separate and divide where there's a more unitive approach to these things in catechesis. So I've been surprised by the sort of use of scripture. The sort of unitive character of knowledge and love in patristic catechesis, this sense of the real sort of sort of sacramental character of the whole enterprise of catechesis. Like
Right.
this is a, yes, this is basic Christian doctrine, that this is what you instruct new people about. And yet it's also these sort of deep wells that that Christians can return to again and again throughout the Christian life and never sort of reach the bottom of the well. You never sort of exhaust the Lord's Prayer, right?
Right.
So it's that sort of element of the continual depth and mystery that one finds in catechesis as a sort of constant well that one can return to. And this to me is retained a lot in later writers, people like Martin Luther, or George Herbert, who are also writing about catechesis and heap a lot of scorn on people that think they're like, oh, I've learned the catechism, I'm done with that. I can go on to, better and brighter things. And they just have no tolerance for that. They are It's sort of like you really you got it? You think you've got the creed? Yeah, you've got the mystery of Christ. Pride is creeping in at the door. And man, Luther's absolutely hilarious on this kind of thing. So that would be another thing I would add to that sort of surprise was just like the bottomless well, the depth of especially patristic catechesis, but I think many of that, much of that carries into later periods as well.
Right, and you go through that. You go through the Middle Ages, right? The reformers, kind of the disdain they had for the Middle Ages in some ways, like, hey, the Catholic Church has not been doing this right for a long time. We're going to fix it with all our the bajillion catechisms we're going to publish. But a lot of stuff going on there. One of the things that I was completely new to me. was how you took us to catechesis, catechumens in other parts of the world, such as China and Ethiopia. There were some of the anecdotes you shared that I had never heard of those before. What do you think? And I'm leading into our discussion. I want to get to the topic of place here, but let's start here where, you looked to these non-Western sources. What do you think Westerners in this catechesis conversation can learn, looking abroad like that?
Yeah, that's a great point. And the book is very much written for kind of a North American Christian audience, but it's attempting both in looking backwards to the patristic and to the historical context more generally, but also to the global context. One is just alleviated of any sense of complacency that we might have. So when looking to the more global context, one just sees, I think, and in looking at the patristics, one just sees the inevitability of some form of catechumenate. Like when you're engaged in mission, you cannot but have some sort of catechumenate. And I think the sort of like forgetfulness of catechesis comes from this kind of, I mean, broadly speaking, a kind of Christendom context where you're just assuming everyone is a Christian and no one needs to be sort of transformed. So it might come out of that kind of like a kind of complacency or something like that, and a forgetfulness of mission. But one of the sort of refrains of the book is like wherever there is mission, there's going to be some form of catechesis. This kind of struck me in a little bit of the research about Roman Catholic catechetical renewal in the 20th century. We're now in a today in a context today, as you mentioned, that catechesis for us is kind of automatically assumed to be a Catholic thing. A, we forget that it was actually a Reformation sort of thing, and then 16th century Catholics were like, "Oh, we need to do this too. We're getting bested by the Protestants here," and they did a lot of work in producing Roman Catholics did a lot of work producing catechisms in the 16th century. But in the 20th century, when you look at kind of early 20th century, you get a lot of these, especially more kind of German Roman Catholic contexts. They're very like skeptical of the catechism because it's not up to date with like the modern pedagogy methods that are more about the experience of faith in the 20th century. So early 20th century, you do not have like this catechetical renewal going on. There's a liturgical, it starts to happen with people like Josef Jungmann and the sort of liturgical renewal. But it's tied. So I see my sort of take on the Catholic catechetical renewal of the 20th century. It's this convergence of the rediscovery of patristic catechesis and the context of global mission. Like at the same time, you have some of these European North American Catholics sort of rediscovering the patristic catechumenate. People like the Nouvelle Theologian John Danielu has a wonderful book on patristic catechesis written in the mid-20th century. At the same time, you have missionaries, Catholic missionaries in Africa, in Southeast Asia, and in Latin America, who are encountering sort of real paganism again, just like the patristics were, and realizing, oh, you can't just like give this person like a 4-point little bullet point text and get them converted. Like they need a period of time. They need a process, whether it's 40 days or 4 years. There was this rediscovery by necessity in the missionary, in the global mission field, that was a very instructive part of the renewal of catechesis. And so you have both of those streams. You have the global mission, and then you have the sort of patristic ressourcement happening in the 20th century. And I think both of those converge to get what occurs after Vatican II with the RCIA, and then eventually the publication of the Catholic Catechism in the early 90s. Like, so it's this really, I think, fascinating like convergence where you see this global mission and then rediscovery of the patristic tradition. Yeah,
feeds
and
into this retrieval of catechesis.
yeah, and thinking about that, the attention to global mission, one of the topics that Ciceronian Society is really big on is the subject of place. And so thinking about the Western non-Western distinction, but where does that notion of place fit in with catechesis? Because there seems to be some elements of catechesis that are universal, right? The Lord's Prayer, the creeds. I'm wondering where, if anywhere, does the particular and local come in? I mean, is that even, if is catechesis essentially always universal, in a sense, like in terms of the content, the style, the reasons? I think the answer, of course, is yes to a point. I'm just wondering, because it's going to look different in so many different ways, and I'm wondering how we think of the concept of place in relation to catechesis. As we're going through this, not only missionally, but here locally as well.
This was, I think that's a great point. And this was partly formed by my own context. I spent 4 years in Vancouver, British Columbia, and then the next 9 years in Central Texas. And so, like, those
Very
are just
different.
very two different contexts and different ways of thinking about place. And that both of those having a very secular urban area and then a very Christian university middle of Texas kind of place was very helpful in thinking about the need for catechesis in both contexts. Another sort of person who I've thought about this a lot is my good friend Ryan Jones, who was a developed a he and his wife Elizabeth planted a church in downtown San Francisco. I talk a little bit about them in the book. They're in downtown San Francisco, and they're thinking about the catechumenate in that context, which is much more like Vancouver. And I'm thinking about it in Texas, and from North Carolina originally. So thinking about it in very very different kinds of contexts really struck home to me the importance of that. It's a hand in hand between the faith handed down once. This is the apostolic tradition, right? This is what the church has received, and it's passed on to the next generation. So there is certainly, I think, a sense of the universal aspect of that. Like the place is not dictating what the gospel is or who Jesus is. It's not sort of like dictating the terms. But it is, our particular context, our particular traditions, are the only context in which we can receive the faith once handed down. So certainly there's the sort of universal element, the sort of the element that is the same everywhere, always, and that sort of thing. But I think the importance of place comes down both to the local geographical place. In the sense that this is the faith once handed down that is brought to bear in this particular community. And that particular community, at the parish level, that's going to look different than it's going to look like even at the parish down the street. I think there's that level of particularity. And then it even comes down to actually, just a year by year, there's a difference in the way that a community is going to be receiving these core tenets of the Christian faith. This really struck home to me after just teaching. When I was in Texas, our church would just do basically a year-long, a 9-month kind of school year-long catechesis, in which we'd walk through the Creed, the Lord's Prayer, the Ten Commandments, using the ACNA catechism to be a Christian. And it was in the context of teaching ostensibly the same thing every year, but realizing because of the kind of, I think, unique kind of pedagogy that catechesis is, it's very dialogical. It's very much engaging with the questions that people have. It was never the same twice. Like it was, each year, because there are different people there, they're asking different questions, and they're
wondering about different things. There's different challenges. So even at that more, a slightly more granular level than even the parish level, there's a sort of particularity to catechesis that is like, this is the faith once handed down, but it's handed down to this particular person, right? Even if you think of the sort of the language of the creed, the credo, the baptismal creed, what we now have is the Apostles' Creed, is typically the creed that's associated more with baptismal instruction. It's in the first person singular. It's I believe, right? The Nicene Creed is in the plural. We believe this is the faith of the church. But there's so capturing both that universal, this is the faith of the church. Like you don't make up this faith. You don't get to like choose what you want to believe today. At the same time, this is the faith handed down and received by this individual person such that they join their credo to the voice of the church as a whole, the credo of the church. So I think that, and this only occurs though when you think of catechesis, the pedagogy of catechesis, not just as a, I'm just going to tell you what you need to know and you just need to receive it. There's a much more sort of dialogical character to a catechetical pedagogy. It's more of a active engagement on the part of the learner than what you typically have if you're thinking of education in kind of more kind of modern 20th century terms, is just here's the information that you must receive into your computing processing systems
Right.
and be able to sort of spit out some.
Well, yeah, and it's a I think what you're getting at too is it's just a better anthropology to not think of us in terms of here's your information, just download it and everything will be fine. And
That's
that
right.
actually gets to a point I wanted to bring up. Hans Boersma writes the foreword to your book, which is great. And he writes this. He writes, Fogelman, solidly rooted within patristic theology, never makes the mistake of pitting desire over against knowledge or heart over against head. It's a great quote, great compliment to you. And I agree with Boersma, but why is that important? I mean, you're already getting there, I think, with a lot of these things, but why is that important to not pit desire against knowledge or heart over against head? Because actually, just saying that out loud, I didn't think of this before, but from the patristic perspective, that's in some ways that's distinguishing them from the classical paideia, right? The Stoic notion. Anyways, what do you make of that?
This is something that I've been thinking about for a long time with 10 years ago when or so, it's probably been longer than that, when the Jamie Smith books came out.
Oh
Like
yeah.
I was of a generation of evangelicals that that's what we read.
Right.
We all read those books, Desiring the Kingdom, and so forth. And that was the sort of mantra of that book was like moving, he's coming from a more kind of reformed context, but moving from the head to the heart, really emphasizing the affective character of, and for him, it was very much an anthropological, as much as a pedagogical question, that the human is a desiring creature, not just a thinking thing. But it's occurred to me, and I was like, yeah, absolutely, 100%. Like, and that's like, how a lot of people get to sort of liturgical, theology in Anglicanism, right? There's it's part of the attraction of Anglicanism is a rich sort of studied tradition of liturgical formation. But it just so when I read that, and he points to Augustine a lot, and then so I read Augustine, and I was like, this totally tracks. But yet the patristics don't talk the way that Jamie Smith talks.
Right.
To emphasize the affective character of the Christian life, they don't have to repudiate the intellectual life. They emphasize the intellect a lot, right? They see the Logos, Christ as Logos, as the fundamental logic of the universe. So it was in that realization that to emphasize the kind of things that I thought somebody like Jamie Smith rightfully emphasized, they didn't have to downplay the intellectual life, in Hans's words, pitting them against each other. And I think 100% I think James Smith would agree with that. He would not want to pit them against one another. I think his project is about elevating the affective character of human life and of pedagogy, not trying to downplay the intellectual life. But I think because of the categories that were given in modernity, we are constantly tempted to a zero-sum game of saying of in order to emphasize the affect, you have to downplay the intellect. Part of one of my favorite books that I mention too often nowadays, but is Andrew Loft's book, Discerning the Mystery. And that's, a book that if you're wanting to know what I said, but in a better, more sophisticated way, you can read Andrew Loft's book, Discerning the Mystery. And this is a fundamental sort of thing that he's working with in that book. Both looking at sort of modern sort of hermeneutical trajectory of modernity, but also seeing patristic conceptions of liturgy and scriptural reading as a way of getting at better what is sort of rendered asunder in modernity. So this is a wonderful portrayal of I think that sort of refusal to pit knowledge and love against one another.
Keeping that in mind, I'm wondering if you could speak to, part of our part of our goal as a society is to encourage Christian scholars as they serve the church. But it's not always clear what that means and what that looks like practically. Catechesis seems to be a place where we as scholars have a particular opportunity to serve the church. Same thing with classical educators, graduate students. That's actually how I got involved in the Anglican Church. So I lived in Alexandria, Virginia, and there was this church there, and they were teaching amazing classes, but they didn't have, and they had, because everyone in the church had a PhD, which is, of course, a very strange situation to be in. And so we had classes on Tocqueville, we had classes on Niebuhr, Augustine, American religious history. Was absurd. And so, assuming that most people are not going to experience that level of church formation and discipleship and catechesis, but I'm just wondering, what does it look like? What do we tell, the person with a PhD? Where do you serve in the church? Where do you belong? Because especially in the evangelical world, and really not just the evangelical world, but throughout the church, people like you and I with PhDs, and they're like, hey, you're really smart. They either really suspicious, oh, you must be a left wing nut job, and please get out of here. You're gonna lead everybody away. Or they're like, well, you actually believe all this stuff, and you're it's it, they don't know what to do with us. I'm just wondering where that fits in the story of catechesis in the modern church, right?
Yeah, that's great. That's another example I think you see, I think as well exemplified in the early church as a sort of good use of in gifted intellects to broaden service to the church. And I think that's very much right for our context today. We don't typically think of a sort of natural home for educators within the church. It's like we know the institution that you belong to. It's called the school.
Right.
And that's a different institution than we are. And this sort of like real strong sort of like you belong over here. We're at church and you can either, serve as a priest or pastor. And there's kind of some overlap between teaching there. So it's like you either do that, you're either a preacher, or like the only other ways for you to serve is like, you can count the money, you can volunteer with children, watch children, or you can fix some stuff when it's broken, That's like I mean, sort of, and I do think that sort of like I've come across this once or twice, like a kind of intimidation of like among pastors will be sort of like, oh, we've got all these PhDs in the room. They're so smart, blah, blah, blah. And it's kind of like, listen, we're just all here because we're hungry, So there's things that can happen on both sides there. There's a sort of, and I've also seen wonderful pastors and priests who are absolutely not intimidated by academics and who could preach to them and also find a place for them to use their gifts within the parish. It's a beautiful thing when you have a pastor who can just see the gifts that the people in front of them have and then unleash them for ministry. It's just amazing. And so I see more and more of this as you've probably seen as well, classical education that's emerging out of churches. You have churches as sort of overseers of classical schools. Like you see more of that kind of thing emerging. But it's also just a way to say that when you get over that sort of like false piety, that's like we need to downplay the life of the mind in order to emphasize a sort of spirituality of worship and stuff. When you kind of get over that thing, you can then really see all the natural places for educators to find themselves serving, using their gifts from within the church. And I find that educators love this because all of the things that they hate about education, like all the bureaucracy, all the grading and the plagiarism and the sort of like all of that stuff, you know, it's just like when you're in the context of educating within a church, like all that's gone. Like the people are there, they're super hungry. They're like, oh, I want to learn, I want to grow because the human mind is made for wonder and for knowing and growing. And it's like people, there's this like ready-made context for people who want to learn, have a deep hunger for something more substantive than the kind of low-grade fare that they're often you often get in sort of like some forms of Christian piety. That, you know, it's just a wonderful place for them to serve. So there's a lot of sort of underlying work that I think needs to happen in order for that to really flourish, but we're starting to see it more and more. You and I are both fans of Brazos Fellows and Brazos Society's project, and that is another one of these contexts that I think is just a outstanding model of what it looks like to bring education within the life of the church, within the rhythms of prayer and worship that a church is doing, but sort of, you know, having this really robust educational approach. So I see it happening. You probably have you've seen this occurring as well. We see it sure occurring in these pockets, and you see it and you're like, why doesn't everybody do this? This is amazing. So I'm hopeful. I come to this kind of despite all the sort of plenty of occasions for doom and gloom, actually lots of occasions for hope, for how the educators and the church can really come together well.
Well, and Brazos Fellows is a great example. I'm actually interviewing Paul next week for the show. So Paul
Oh, good. There
Gettiker.
we
So
go. Yeah.
perfect timing. You set it up.
Yeah.
Two remaining questions. I want to actually go to a there's a quote here on page 133 that I think is really important. You say catechesis is not a prepackaged meal ready-made for the catechist to serve up by heating it in the microwave. Catechesis is not asking new Christians to watch a video or fill out a workbook or even study a catechism on their own. It is inherently relational. I think it's a really important point here. And if we attempt to offload the relational burdens, as you say, quote unquote, burdens of catechesis, we risk losing one of its most central goods, the personal bonds of friendship, where the Word of God exerts its irresistibly beautiful appeal. Now, I know we don't have a ton of time here, but that aspect of friendship in catechesis. I circled that paragraph because to me that was a key part. And we as academics, right? We have our friends, but I covet your office, right? Because I being able to hide there would be great. I don't have an office, and so it's just like I would, we and also we're academics. We can be awkward. Let's just call it what it is.
Yeah.
Obviously not us,
Not us.
No, not ever.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, a piece of this. Where does
Yeah.
friendship fit in this in catechesis?
Yeah. No, that's it. That's a great, I think that's so important. It goes back to that sort of personal dimension, that sort of particularizing character of catechesis. I've thought more and more that the skills, I think it's a lot about catechist training. Like, how do we help someone become a catechist? And Sure, being an eloquent orator, is great, and that's a wonderful thing. But I've come to think that a good catechist has a lot more in common with a spiritual director, and it's someone who takes the time to listen and to perceive the sort of depth and questions that the catechumen has. And not just seeing their job as, well, I just need to answer every question. There is as much of a sense that the catechist should be able to listen and attend to the human depth that is right there in front of them. And so this sort of aspect of friendship, or the name of that chapter in the book, is the relational dimension of catechesis. And some of that thinking comes from the language of burdens that comes from Albert Bourdmond, who thinks a lot about technology, and very, very much thinking about what it does to us. So thinking about the ways that, yeah, there technology is often sold to us as a way to alleviate us of burdens. We microwave the food, and it alleviates the burden of having to prepare food. Well, sure, it does ostensibly do that, but in relieving you from those burdens, it also untethers you from the relationships and that go into making the food. And as you were talking about earlier, the context, the particular, the connection to place. So in taking away these burdens, technology is also taking away a lot of things that make us human. And now we're realizing all this and figuring out what to do. And so I see some of the same things happening with catechesis. It's like, oh, and I was a part of like developing an app for the catechism, and I just got a smartphone like 2 weeks ago, and it's so I was thinking about catechesis, but also thinking about, how are we thinking about pedagogy and education, and especially in a technological age? Like, what are the things that are happening there? And it pushed me back to thinking about that, the significance of relationships and friendship, as an essential and not just sort of peripheral aspect of catechesis. And so I think that's just such an important dimension. You can't offload the work of catechesis and say, oh, just read this book, look at this app, watch the video, and my work here is done, right? So it is absolutely essential. And yes, we are awkward and like whatever. And but the ability to continue to sit through that, I think will be especially helpful. We're sort of conditioned now to sort of say anything that's awkward or uncomfortable, like I can just swipe you to the left and I don't have to deal with that, right? But for us, I think one of the sort of maybe spiritual disciplines we might embrace is just not swiping people away. Be able to sit with them, be able to sit through that, and then I think we'll allow those sorts of connections to come through, and you hear the question that people are asking behind their question. I've encountered this several times in catechesis where someone will be asking a question about, well, why do we address God as Father or something like that? And you think they've got maybe this sort of like political edge about what they're asking about, and they're like, oh, actually, maybe you had a difficult relationship with your father. And so there's real pain coming from behind this question. But if you just answer it at the surface level, if you haven't taken the time to sort of like get to know the people that are there, if you just are at the level, I'm just here to answer questions, then you'll just sit there, and I think we'll be missing something that's really significant about catechesis. And this is the passing on of the tradition to this person.
That gets us, a part that we as academics can fail at so miserably. We forget the human behind the ideas, right? In the sense that we just think, well, would just put you in a different camp. You're just thinking this way because you're bought by this ideology or this or because you listened to you read that person, and so now you're whatever. But it's no, there's often pain behind it, especially in churches, right? I was a church administrator for a little bit, and for 2 years, and so much of the church's opportunity, but also failures, has come in responses to pain, right? Real pain. And especially nowadays, I don't know about you, but this is happening a lot, I think, especially in these more liturgical traditions where our generation of people are they're bringing their families to church, but they're also bringing a lot of, and again, this is a whole different podcast, but a lot of skepticism about church, and because they weren't catechized. Or actually, let me say this. The other problem is that there's been an anti-catechesis. I don't know if that's the right word.
That's right.
Yeah, and I think in that again, that's a whole other podcast. We don't have time for that. But a lot of what we're doing as catechists is responding to overturning or resisting the catechesis that these people walk in with, that you and I walk in with, right?
That's right.
I mean, I certainly have been catechized towards certain things that I'm ashamed of, or that I still have to unlearn every day, right? I think, I mean, yeah, again, I could go on there. Speaking of catechists, before you have to go, I want to give you a chance to talk about Robert Weber, the Weber Center specifically that you're a part of. I think this is a great program at Trinity, and I'd love to give our listeners a chance to hear about it.
So Robert Weber was one of these great sort of champions of the tradition for evangelicals. So the Robert Weber Center was founded and started around the time around the time of his passing. It came to Trinity in 2012. And one of my predecessors, Joel Skandret, who was taught is a professor here, but he came to sort of help really launch and direct that program. And so it's done a lot in continuing that legacy of retrieving the tradition, but also specifically with the aim of catechetical formation in mind. And so in addition to things like hosting conferences and lectures on sort of what we can draw from the early church for the Christian life today, one of the things that the Weber Center's done is helped start a catechist certificate program here at Trinity. And so that's something we offer, and a number of folks here have been involved with the Catechesis Task Force for the ACNA. So we're thinking about catechist training here. This is also now tying in with our Doctor of Ministry program. So we're going to be launching a Doctor of Ministry cohort here next year that's specifically on catechesis and discipleship. Your listeners want to come and join us conspiring towards the good of catechesis in the church today. That's some of the things that we're building over here.
That should be the title of this episode, the catechetical conspiracy. But
That's
I can't even say
right.
it, so it may not work well.
So
Well,
you know it's good.
Alex, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Absolutely wonderful to be with you.
Excellent. Well, folks, please take a look at this book. I'll leave a link to it in the show notes as well as the Weber Center. This is a great opportunity, a really, really good book to read. I encourage those of you who are looking at, future Ciceronian Society conferences, everything in this book you could build on for research papers or topics or panel topics. It's a great topic of conversation. All right, so you've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. If you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for a future event. We'll be having our 2026 conference at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, March 12th through the 14th. Sponsorship opportunities are still available. Be sure to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. Thank you for listening.